Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'm your host, Jackie Marie Beyer. Let's get growing.
Welcome to the show, David, and go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself.
Sure. So I'm a biologist by trade, a wildlife biologist. But, you know, my interests are more broad than even that. I'm fascinated by the natural world. I consider myself, you know, a naturalist more than just, you know, wildlife biologist, in that I love birding, insects, plants, and everything related. And obviously my career path has taken me to a place where I can do that full time. I also have a background, unlike a lot of biologists, I have a background in art and architecture and design. I love building things. And that's kind of where my interest in art and architecture really started at an early age as well. I'm a welder, woodworker. In college, I painted. And I just like to make things. And I love to cook. And that's probably because I love to eat. And that really keeps me busy gardening.
So are you from Montana? Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Maryland. I've lived in Missoula, Montana for 22 years now. It's a wonderful place to be for a lot of reasons, but especially, you know, with the career of in fish and wildlife management. So
how'd you get to Missoula from Maryland?
Yeah, it was kind of a good question. They're very far apart. You know, both. And I think about, I love growing up where I did in Maryland. I had a lot of opportunities, especially, the opportunity to explore the eastern hardwood forests and things like that. I love growing up there. I mean, in terms of wildlife and insects and reptiles and amphibians, it was such a neat place to be from. Montana, you know, from a young age, was always a place I really had a fascination with, and I hope, you know, someday I'd be able to come out here. Unfortunately, I've been able to, I was able to get a job here and stay.
Cool. Me too. I grew up in New York and read a book about Montana when I was in fourth grade. And
I'm
moving out there. And when I was in college, I got a map out and sat at the kitchen table and said, this is where the trees are. And FBCC wasn't quite big enough. So then the next one was Missoula, and went to U of M and met my husband planting trees for the Forest Service, and been up in Eureka ever since. 22
That's
years
great.
Ago, or 23,
oh,
I guess.
Right?
We just celebrated 22 years of marriage, like June, the beginning of June.
Wait, oh, that's and, all right. Well, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I was going to tell you, I always think there's a funny story. This girl that was one of when I was getting my teaching certificate in my class, who just wanted to go to Maryland. She's like, doesn't that just sound like the prettiest place, Maryland?
Well, you know, it's pretty neat. You know, I really have very fond memories of it. And, you know, there's some things, and that's one thing I like, and I think that's kind of expressed in my gardening, is just a sense of place. And, you know, whether you're in Maryland or whether you're in Montana, there's so much to love about those places and every place in between. And the uniqueness of our landscapes and the diversity of our plants and wildlife and landscapes is so important to preserve. And that's been one of my biggest frustrations, you know, with, the landscape industry or garden design industry, is the homogenization of the U.S. Because we have such a diverse, you know, it's such diverse and beautiful landscape in this country, you know, palettes of plants and animals that occur nowhere else in the world. And people are so quick to give up on those and transform, you know, their garden into what, unfortunately, was, you know, is an ideal from France and England or something else, but not our climate and not our place. I think my blog, Montana Wildlife Gardener, if I still lived in Maryland, it would be probably Montana or the Maryland Wildlife Gardener, and have a very much, much different take on things. But it would hopefully be equally beautiful and an equal representation of the, the place I choose to be or the place I am.
Excellent. Hey, and maybe afterwards we could talk about maybe know someone in Maryland, because I don't think I've had a guest from Maryland, and I'm trying to get someone from all 50 states. So.
Oh, okay. There's a few, and most people I just kind of know from blogs and stuff, but like Susan Harris.
Okay.
And then there's some other people too. People that are, Garden Ranch.
Mm-hmm.
I think that blog. They I think there's a few of them from Maryland.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
And I think people are always surprised. Growing up in New York, there are tons of nature preserves and beautiful places on Long Island to go hiking. And that's certainly where my love of nature was developed. So, a lot of people think the East Coast is just all cities, but they've definitely, preserved some really nice spots. So, David, let's talk about your very first garden. I always kind of like to start the show off just by asking people, who were you with? How old were you? A kid, an adult? What'd you grow? Just tell us kind of quickly about your very first gardening experience.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't know that I have one. I wish I could tell you I remember the first time I put my hands in the soil and planted a pea or something and watched it grow. But, unfortunately, I don't have that kind of memory. But to me, gardening is so much more about growing plants in a way. It's about spending time outside, living outdoors. I think people a lot of times isolate themselves from the outside world and even, think of their homes as being separate from nature, or even their gardens being separate from nature. And to me, it's kind of one and the same. I like creating comfortable and interesting spaces outside in the garden. And when I talk about garden, I'm talking about my whole yard. And in my yard, I have a vegetable garden, and then the rest of it is all native plants. I don't have any lawn. And I have a lot of really interesting, fascinating places to explore. And I love it. And it's what I consider every successful garden to be is an expansion of your lifestyle or an expression of your lifestyle. My garden is so integrated into who I am in that sense and what I'm trying to do, or just getting an interest in nature. And then since then, that's what I've strived to do at home, is to create a garden that represents, the place where I live. And in this case, Shortgrass Prairie of Montana, and providing habitat for wildlife and providing a place for me to explore, and comfortable outdoor living spaces, places to cook, to eat, to socialize, places to grow vegetables that my wife and I enjoy doing, and we enjoy canning and preserving foods that we can eat all year. A lot of outdoor spaces in our yard where we can simply enjoy being outside and being connected to nature.
So how big is your garden then? It sounds like it's pretty big.
It's teeny by most people's standards. We have I live just on a, small city lot in the center of Missoula, Montana.
Oh, you do? You're right in town?
Right in town. And there's a lot of reasons for that. One, I work on one side of town. My wife works on the other side of town. So we live right in the middle. So it's inconvenient or convenient for both of us. It's a small town, so it's not that far apart. But it makes sense. We're close to, in terms of our, again, kind of going back to what our lifestyle is and what we like to do. We're both biologists. We love spending time outdoors. We love fishing, hunting, hiking, birding, all that stuff. And we live right in the middle of town, so we can do it. And that might sound funny, but it puts us close to services. We can walk to the grocery store, we can walk to work, we can walk downtown or take our bikes everywhere. And that's how we commute, by bicycle to every place.
That's one of the best things about Missoula, I think. And something I miss the most about going to school there was being able, like, I always was like, I could race any car anywhere in this town and beat you.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't save you a lot of time driving.
No.
And especially once you get over that sort of, once you recognize that, yeah, it's, there's a lot of reasons to drive, but there's also a lot of reasons not to drive places. But, you know, one of the things, you know, I think every garden, every, like I said, every successful garden should be a reflection of your, of that person's lifestyle. Everybody's goals and their, for their garden is unique and different. And that's what makes it special. I mean, I think when you look at somebody's yard, you should be able to learn about them a little bit. And our, the goals for our yard were probably a little more, maybe structured than other people, but we actually wrote down, you know, the goals for our garden a long time ago. Because again, this was, something that was very important to us as biologists, and everything, that we wanted a place for wildlife, but we also wanted a place for ourselves. You know, to come from, you know, we have a small house, and this is an expansion. Our garden is an expansion of our living space. But we wanted to do a few things that were unique and potentially challenging. And one of them was to garden with a sense of place. You know, we live, like I said, in the middle of a short grass prairie in Montana. And that aesthetic really has never been captured or depicted in the, you know, conventional gardening magazines or books or things like that. You look up like Western or gardening or xeriscaping and get pictures from Arizona of some boulders and a saguaro cactus. And while that's beautiful, that's not what we have here. Or you see like garden pictures from, you know, the Rocky Mountain West. And it's like somebody in Colorado with, you know, boulders and some blue spruce and Colorado columbine. Again, that's neat, but it's not what we have here. And just from a conservation perspective, the short grass prairie is what I think one of the most beautiful landscapes in the country. And it's one of the most underappreciated. People look at prairies as the absence of things rather than really what they contain. And to me, it's the most American landscape. You know, it has a lot of romance in the prairie. It's been depicted in songs and things. But to experience a prairie, it's vast, beautiful, it's complex, and it's poorly understood. Like I said, I grew up in Maryland, in the middle of, you know, eastern hardwood forest, and the prairie of Montana is. The prairies in Montana is about as different as you can get. And that's what I love about both of them. So going back to my garden, you can tell I easily get distracted on some of these topics. But
that's okay. It's, you know, it's enjoyable to hear.
Well, thank you. So I wanted to create, you know, a Montana garden using plants that are only native to the Missoula area. And that might seem really limiting, but that was seemed really appropriate. Because when you talk about, you know, native plants, you know, what does that mean? You know, what's native in the U.S. is meaningless when you're in one place or another. And the same thing holds true in Montana. You know, what, if you talk about a Montana native plant, what's going to grow well in Eureka is going to be a lot different than what's going to thrive in Jordan or Ekalaka. You know, there's so much diversity in this
or
state.
Even like up here we have different little climate patches, and like Whitefish, yeah, which is, you know, 45 minutes south of me, you know, because they're a higher elevation, they're different. And then Libby, mm-hmm, which is 50 miles west of us, you know, because it goes down to almost sea level, and then Troy right after that, you know, they can grow so many things that we can't grow here.
Exactly.
So
yeah,
there's Montana's a lot of different.
It is. And just looking at some of the common metrics you see aren't really that informative. If you look at, like, precipitation, you know, Missoula gets 13 inches of precipitation a year. Most of that's in the winter in the form of snow. But that doesn't tell the whole story. You know, we have, even though it's dry, we're pretty moderate here compared to a lot of the rest of the state. When we don't have wind, you know, high winds, we don't have hail and things like that. So we can grow a lot more than places that have a lot more precipitation, you know, east of the divide, for example. So, you know, just, and obviously the more local you get in terms of your plant selection, the better success you're going to have. And the better success you're going to have if your goal is to attract wildlife. And that, again, was one of our biggest goals. So just using Missoula native plants, we wanted to create a landscape. And again, that landscape was to provide for wildlife as well as ourselves.
So I'm curious
interesting about
the wildlife that you're bringing in, if you're right in the middle of town, because I know a lot of people are probably like, well, I wouldn't want to like have raccoons coming in and attracting skunks.
Yeah.
Or, so what kind of wildlife are you attracting right there in the middle of town?
Yeah.
I mean, your place on your blog, I thought you were way out and like coming to town today to do this interview because you lived way out in the middle of nowhere. And
No, not at all. Yeah, that's neat. I mean, it's neat to hear that you saw pictures of our garden and you assumed we were somewhere else, and we're not. We're literally right in the middle of town, because of that, there are reasonable expectations we have about what wildlife we want to attract versus what we can attract, and we don't get things in our neighborhood like bears, for example. Mm-hmm. We don't even really get deer in our neighborhood, although, I mean, this is going to sound funny to a lot of people, but I would love it if we could get deer in our yard. So the types of wildlife that I'm talking about are, you know, insects, birds, and even small mammals. But primarily what we'll, you know, just again, going back to the reasonable expectations, even though, we in Missoula has, you know, migratory elk herds within sight of downtown, you know, we can plant all the blue bunch wheatgrass in the world in our front yard and we're not going to be able to draw them in, you know, and it probably wouldn't be a good thing, you know, too. But so, you know, realistically, you know, based on where we were, it's insects and birds. And just with birds in mind, you know, we've had over 70 species of birds use our yard.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And when I say use the yard, it doesn't mean like a bald eagle flying overhead. It's something, you know, inside the yard, on the ground, in a tree, doing something, interacting with the garden. And the reason we've had so much success that way is because of the diversity and the prevalence of native plants in our yard. And the reason why is, for the most part, birds eat insects. And insects, you know, eat plants. And the plants that they eat are going to be the native plants because those are the ones that they're that they've evolved with, that they have a relationship with, and they provide typically the food for the larvae of insects. And that's what birds eat. We don't really have conventional bird feeders, as you would call them. We don't hang up bird feeders or things like that, but our yard is a feeder. So we've created this habitat that wildlife are responding to. Like numbers of things. That's why I mentioned we've had over 70 species of birds in the garden, but the countless number of insects and the really cool interactions and things that can happen, you know, even in a small city lot are just amazing. Just by providing the habitat and this case, not only plants, but things that you find in the natural world, standing snags, rocks, brush piles, you know, those sorts of habitat features really attract animals, and it's been very successful. And it's, you know, allowed us to create, you know, interesting place in the garden, but an interesting place for us too, and that's really important. One of the big reasons.
I was just going to say, so yesterday I was interviewing a woman from Canada who grows wildflowers, and she was talking about farmers who plant wildflowers, like even if they're like on the edge of their garden, their vegetable yields are, increase a lot because they're bringing all those pollinators in. And also I talked to this lady from a bird feeder company out of Pennsylvania, and she talked about having those kind of places like the snags and the brush and different little, shelters for birds to hang out, that also helps increase your...
Exactly.
Cool. So you're going to share with us some of the native plants that you have growing, or do you have fruit trees?
What's that?
Do you have fruit trees or anything like that, or special trees?
Did you say fruit or fur? Wait, I'm sorry.
Fruit trees, like apples or pears or.
Well, yeah. So we have, so in terms of native plants.
Which I guess
plants,
they're not native.
Right. So we have a lot of, so we have over 100 species of native plants in our yard. And that's, it's kind of funny to think about that because, you know, like I mentioned, you know, our goal was just to use plants that are native to the Missoula area. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of people, including, like, you know, a lot of gardeners or native plant enthusiasts that say, well, that's going to be really limiting, you know, in terms of what you can plant. And it's not
that's
at
not
all. And that diversity of plants means, you know, several things. One, we have stuff flowering from March through October.
Nice.
We always have something in flower. And one of our simple kind of objectives from this whole thing was we just wanted to go outside and see a lot of flowers. I mean, it sounds silly, but it's nice to have flowers all the time. We have an abundance of flowers. I mean, especially, especially seasonally, we usually have a 5-gallon bucket on the sidewalk in our front yard with free cut flowers for people because, the native plants we grow by planting like the right plant in the right place, they thrive. And again, going back to some of the goals of our garden, the big thing we wanted to accomplish was not to irrigate. And the only thing we water or provide irrigation to is our vegetables. Because, I think that water is such a scarce resource that we really need to be thoughtful about how we use it. And for even though I love my my landscape, my garden, they're just ornamental plants in a sense. And I don't really think that's a great use for, especially drinking water, because that's what we'd be putting on our lawn, mm-hmm. in our yard. Mm-hmm. I really think the best use for water is something you're going to eat. So the only place in our garden that gets irrigated is our vegetable garden. The rest of our yard, most of it hasn't been watered in 10 to 15 years. And it does really well because we've selected plants that are right for that site, not just plants that are native to Montana, not just plants that are native to Missoula, but, you know, picking the exact spot for those plants.
Even this spring, we've had such a dry spring, you haven't had to water at all?
Yeah.
Nice.
No, and I don't want to. I mean, a couple of reasons. One is I want to see what, I don't want a baby plant. I want them to survive. And I know, you know, you go out in the woods or out in the prairies, there's plants all the time. That doesn't get tended. So finding what's going to really survive some of these little, you know, microclimates in your yard is kind of a fun challenge. So I don't want to, you know, baby a plant along. My typical strategy is, you know, once a plant gets established, we don't water it at all. And that establishment might take one season or maybe a full year, depending on the plant and depending on the, you know, location and size and things like that. But then that's it. It's on its own. And the one thing, one of the many things I like about that in terms of, you know, the stages the plant goes through is you really get to experience everything from a plant, from its growth, its maturity, and even its senescence. And that's what you see in nature. And that's what kind of connects me to the natural world, or connects our garden. It looks appropriate. You know, when you drive around Missoula or, you know, any city in the semi-arid west in July and August, and you go through all these like lush green lawns, but you look out on the horizon and you see, you know, the prairies or mountains that are very different color. It just doesn't feel right. You know, so right now, you know, our garden is in the process of plants are curing, they're turning beautiful golden brown or tans or sage color, and it just seems like the appropriate time and the appropriate color for this season. Vegetable-wise, we water them because that's what we're going to eat, and we couldn't, you know, most of the vegetables we grow are not native plants, not native to this continent, and they need water. Or they need heat. It's our biggest thing. That's why we have a greenhouse, because I like to grow plants. Speaking about my interest in eating and interest in cooking, I love my favorite food to cook and eat is Thai food. And the only way we're getting Thai produce is, one, by growing it in Montana, because we don't have a big import market here. But to find fresh foods and specific plants or specific fruits and vegetables or leaves for cooking is to grow them ourselves. So I have a greenhouse, and that's where we grow a lot of Thai peppers, eggplants, lime tree, all sorts of things, chilies, year-round.
Did you say a lime tree?
Lime tree? Yeah, Kaffir lime. Yeah. The leaves, Kaffir lime leaves are used in a lot of Thai curries and stir fries, and it has such a bold, unique flavor. You can't get it anyway else. And in the coldest days in the winter, we'll bring it inside our house. But otherwise, it lives in our greenhouse in a big pot, so easily moved around.
Do you have to, like, in the summer when it gets really hot, do you have to ventilate your greenhouse at all? Or
we do, yeah. That's the funny thing is, mainly, Montana, for listeners that I don't know, I mean, it's dry and it's very hot in the summer.
Yeah.
The sun is really intense. We have really long days. Mm-hmm. So the greenhouse is great for the shoulder seasons, spring, meaning like from March, April and May, and then in the fall from September, October, November.
And then I would think some of those plants, because our nights get pretty cool. I know our nights get quite a bit cooler than yours down in Missoula, but still.
That's what the greenhouse does. It helps, get rid, without a greenhouse, it would get into the 40s and 30s throughout much of the year, and the greenhouse helps moderate that. But in the summer, like right now, with our long days and the intense sun, we have a shade cloth on our greenhouse because it gets too hot, too dry, and that sun is just too intense. But the other thing...
because that's the problem we've had with the greenhouse is that it got too hot and baked everything in the summer.
Yeah, when we have an exhaust fan in there that's a solar fan, and that really helps bringing the air out. And then thermostatically controlled windows too. But the greenhouse actually I designed and built for Montana specifically. So actually the only glazing on it, the only windows on it are on the south side. And like the north side is just conventionally framed and insulated just like a house, and same thing with the east and the west sides. Because the summertime you don't... that's not the problem. It's taking advantage of that low sun. So the angle of the roof is really steep because in the wintertime, the sun's only 27 degrees above the horizon. And if you just had a regular greenhouse, you wouldn't be taking advantage of that. And then the steep roof in the summertime, helps get away from that intense heat.
All right, your architecture background's really coming into play here, I can tell.
All these are fun challenges. Like I said in the beginning, I like to build things. I like to make things. And it's just, just an extension, the whole garden, like I said, is just kind of an extension of my interest and lifestyle, which I think everyone's gardens should be. And the other thing about the goal of our garden was to provide education. And this is probably different than most people's gardens. But because we were trying these things, to use Montana native plants or Missoula native plants, trying not to water, to create a demonstration of what a short grass prairie is, we wanted to use this as an opportunity to educate the public, too. And that's not typically a goal of many people's gardens. So throughout our yard, but especially in our front yard, that's really public, we have interpretive signs explaining what it is we're doing, talking about wildlife gardening, talking about native plants, talking about the Missoula Prairie, and explaining why we don't have a lawn. And it's really helpful. People really have come to like it and enjoy it. And we see people walking by throughout the year to see the changes that go on in the garden over the course of the year.
Awesome.
Yeah, we're trying. We're really trying to provide a different aesthetic and a way to use native plants and create landscapes that are ecologically appropriate, that respect the landscape, and honor the beautiful plant and animal species that we have here, and they're found nowhere else. What we don't have is a lawn with some arborvitae and a couple of tulips, and then complain about the deer eating the tulips. And to me, it's been a lot of fun. It's always such a source of enjoyment to go and look around. And speaking of when you asked about what plants you have, what trees you have, speaking about the diversity of plants, you know, I have a list of species we have in the yard. But one thing I want, and I always talk about that, but I don't think it's that really meaningful to people. So one thing, one of my goals this year was to document, is try and document every flower or every plant that flowers every day. Or what's flower, you know.
Oh my goodness, that sounds like a big project.
Yeah, it was. And, or it is. And so for, there was actually 80 or 81 days straight where I took a picture and posted on my Instagram site of what was flowering that day, what species had just started flowering that day. And and because, you know, a lot of them were kind of in the same period, I missed a whole bunch, some common plants, some grasses, some other things in that period. And now it's kind of slowed down, so I'm able to catch my breath. But it's been a fun project, and to look back and see, you know, all those species flowering. It's amazing, the diversity of plants and just, you know, how many. And then you look at, you know, a typical suite of plants that people use in a landscape, it might only be 5 or 7 species, none of which might be really beneficial to insects or wildlife.
Well, I think listeners are really going to enjoy this
conversation
and
hearing
about
the question was.
Different, you know, solutions that they can try in their yard. And so maybe, probably you didn't start, you probably have been doing this over the years and, you know, kind of started out slowly and then just kind of were adding things as things went along, right?
Yeah, and you know, that's the biggest, well, I think a couple of things. One, gardening, I think, should be fun. It should be enjoyable. It should be, enjoyable. You know, it doesn't have to be complicated. It doesn't have to be expensive. And it should reflect your lifestyle and your interests. But the biggest thing to encourage people is just to start. And start small and slowly build off your successes. Learn from your failures and just keep going. And, you know, it's not, it shouldn't be intimidating. And yet I see so many people intimidated by probably the wealth of information we have out there. And that's unfortunate because, you know, we've been doing this gardening, whether it's vegetables or other plants, for millennia. And we've got a lot of this stuff figured out. And just with how much information is out there, I think it's very overwhelming. But you know, one of the best bits of advice I got about plants is if you don't like it, you can move it. If you really don't like it, you can compost it. And, you know, I think that's really true. And just don't get too attached to anything in particular. And if something doesn't work out, it's not that big of a deal. You can change your landscape. You can change your garden so much easier than changing your kitchen or relocating a living room or putting on a second story in your house.
Where are you getting your native plants then from? Like, do you have a source? Like, do you go out in the woods and bring them home? Or do you go to the nursery? Like, where are you getting all these 100 different species of native plants?
So where do you get native plants? That's a great, great question. And, you know, when we first started landscaping our garden in our house, where we live now, we moved in there in 99. And prior to buying that house, first house my wife and I bought. We were living just a few blocks away. And prior to moving in, we started growing a lot of plants with the idea of the first thing we were going to do was remove the front lawn and plant a native prairie. So we started growing plants in pots, you know, months ahead of time. And those were from seeds that my wife had collected, seeds that we'd collected when we're out fishing or hunting, you know, plants that we see. Most of those were grown from seed originally.
Wow.
And the reason was, is back then, it wasn't even that long ago, but back in 99, there weren't really many options for getting native plants. And that was obviously a big impediment to people. You know, really one of the best places at that time, and still is the Montana Native Plant Society. And there's native plant societies all over the country. That's a great way, if anybody is interested in native plant gardening, start locally with your own native plant society, because there's probably experts there, just like there are here, of what to grow, how to grow it, and where to find it, where to find them. But we got plants from a variety of different sources. Some we collected seeds from. We've never dig up plants from the wild. We collect seeds or cuttings from some. Some salvages was another great places. In the 90s and early 2000s especially, Missoula grew outward. And you know, one of the consequences of that is beautiful prairie was being turned into people's homes. And my wife, who's a botanist, she organized salvage activities where people would go and dig up all the plants before the tractors and bulldozers, graders came in and removed them.
Good for her.
And that, yeah, and that actually supplied us and lots of people in the area with beautiful native plants that are, you know, perfectly adapted to living in Missoula. We also bought a lot of plants from native plant retailers as they became available. Now there's several native plant retailers around. And even, you know, like the big garden centers, we really liked, you know, there's a period of time, probably in the early 2000s, where we really wanted just to show them that people want these plants. So we, you know, not only bought from, you know, local garden centers and things like that, but really encouraged other people too to do that. And now it's, you know, frankly, right now, even in Missoula, it's pretty easy to find native plants. That shouldn't be, you know, an impediment. But it's any you know, it does, again, it doesn't have to be difficult. If you want to just buy plants, buy them. If you want to, you know, some people like the challenge of starting things from seed and like to be able to say, every plant here I started from seed and grew. If that's what you want to do, that's great too. And
now, is
so
that hard to do? Or you just put the seeds
some
in
plants
the
are really
dirt,
hard to grow from seed.
Do you have to do that thing where you, what's it called, stratifying the seed or something?
Yeah. There is a lot to it. And fortunately, in Montana, one of the members of the Native Plant Society, Sheila Morrison, has written a book on how to grow. It's called The Magic of Montana Native Plants, How to Grow 150 Species from Seed. And she has recipes, basically, for every species there of how to grow them. Everyone is different. Some need to be frozen. Some need to be scarred, you know, to mimic if they're going through the gut of a bird or an animal. there's a lot to it. Some need, you know, really well-drained soil. Some need, you know, some clay soil. But by learning that, you can also really see what's going to work best for your yard. But, you know, really for the last 10 years or so, All the plants in our garden have just come from our garden. We've just been moving them around. That's the kind of weeding that I do. We have native plants coming up in our vegetable beds, native plants coming up in the neighbor's lawn, native plants coming up next to native plants and the cracks in the sidewalk. So to me, that's weeding. It's just digging up native plants and moving them somewhere else in the yard or giving them away to other people. But it's just a source of native plants now.
Well, that's really the definition of a weed, right? It's something that's growing where you don't want it to grow.
Yeah, exactly. All weed is something unwanted. And it's a riot that, you know, if you were to come over to my house right now and look in my vegetable garden beds, the plants that you would see, you know, the weeds that are coming up there are all native plants that people probably pay a lot of money for, you know. but because that's the source of seeds. That's the source of weeds in our yard is just is native plants. That's all we have in the yard. It's kind of a nice thing. We have them coming up in the alley. Like I said, I dig them out of my neighbor's lawn, you know? But yeah, it's taken a while and it's been fun to watch. You know, there's some things, you know, one of the real common misconceptions about native plants is one, they aren't suitable for, you know, residential landscape. And that's just silly. They do fine. You can use them in all different, you know, with all different design considerations. You can have very formal landscapes with using native plants. You can have, you know, a wild prairie, for example, using native plants and everything in between. You can create an austere landscape. You can create a cottage garden. Plants are just plants, you know, and I view plants as kind of tools in a landscape, tools in a garden. That's why I don't get, you know, too attached to any one particular one.
What about tools? Do you have a favorite tool that you use?
Yes, I do. It's the, by far my favorite tool is the Digit 2. It was once referred to as the world's best weeding tool. It's made by, the company is called Digit, D-I-G-G-I-T. They're made in the United States. They're made in the United States. They have a lifetime warranty, but you're not going to need it. It's kind of like a modified soil knife or hori hori. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic tool. Yeah. Yeah. And I love, it's funny. I'm not sponsored by them or anything like that, although I wouldn't be opposed to it.
Reach out to them.
They're a great tool. Oh, thank you very much. It's a great tool. And it makes weeding easy. I mean, and I use it for transplanting, all sorts of things. Indestructible too, which is very nice.
Cool.
Yeah.
How about, are you going to share your favorite recipe with us that you like to cook?
Oh gosh, there's so many. My favorite recipe. Yeah.
Really? I thought you were going to have some Thai thing just right off
yeah,
the top
okay,
of your head.
Yeah, I was thinking about like the vegetable garden, because we really haven't talked about our vegetables. You know, but before I forget, one thing it just reminded me of is, some of the, in general, I really like plants that are easy to grow, and that's why I like native plants. I mean, you get the right plant in the right place, it's easy. And I think that, in talking to a lot of gardeners, I think that sort of success inspires people and give them confidence to try new things. And in the vegetable garden, I was just thinking about, what plants are my cornerstones. And some of the perennials, like grapes or strawberries, I guess they're kind of a short-lived perennial, but they do really, really well, especially grapes in the garden.
Before you say that, do you have any secrets? Because we haven't had the easiest time growing grapes.
Oh, really? Yeah, I've heard that. There's a lot of, like, Concord grapes that grow more or less, like, wild in people's gardens in Missoula. I have three or four species of grapes that have done really well, or two of them especially. One's a Steuben Blue, and the other one's a Kay Gray grape. And they're seeded grapes that we use for jelly. That's really all we use them for. And we started off with two vines of Steuben Blue, and we ended up getting rid of one of the vines because we were getting 60 to 80 pounds of grapes a year.
It was
just too much. So we now just have one Steuben Blue grape vine. And actually, we've got a couple of Himrod, some Somerset, and Kay Gray. And the Himrods are new. I'm excited to try those. They're a seedless grape.
Now, where are you getting those from? Are you buying those in Missoula? Are you ordering them online or from a seed catalog?
Yeah, those I've ordered. The Steuben Blue, Kay Gray, and Himrod I've ordered from online places.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool. And, one great reference is for everything is the Cornell Extension Service. Mm-hmm. They have fantastic resources on like grapes for your area and things like that.
Okay,
and I'm not
good.
Just saying that because I went to Cornell, but they are an incredible resource for all things agriculture and stuff.
Well, and also the bird, Judy Hoysock from the Wild Bird Feeder place talked about their bird website, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology.
Yes, yes, yeah. No, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology is world renowned, and they have so much information that's so easily accessible to folks. You don't have to have a PhD in ornithology to understand the information they have there. They've really geared it and made accessible to everybody.
Now she said they have an app that they're coming
looking,
out with.
They've embraced technology again in the way to make that information accessible. They have done a wonderful job in that regard. Like I said, they're a world-renowned, scholarly ornithologist there, but the information that they've made accessible to people is remarkable. You can go to the Cornell Lab of Ornithology or their site. It's called All About Birds, mm-hmm. and it is a fantastic resource for anybody interested in birding or backyard birding or anything like that. But they also have great information about plants and especially vegetables. But that's what I've used as a guide. The only thing I can say with grapes is grow them in full sun and, water them But I mean, I don't really have any secrets.
That could have been it for us because we just dug our well pretty much this year. This is the first year we've really had water to be able to irrigate or do, and that could have been the problem. Was a lack of water.
But you know, and you know, grapes are one of those things that we've been growing those things for thousands of years as a people. You know, I think maybe people try to do too much with them. Baby them too much or care for them too much or something, because they're very long lived, and they're very sturdy. I mean, and they should grow under some stress or some duress. So seasonally, you know, water is really important, but it's not something I think a lot of people overwater them. So,
have to say he planted the plants we planted like the first year. It's probably been 5 or 6 years ago, are still there and they're still growing and they're, but just, it seemed like kind of a struggle. I remember in the beginning and they're just, we were kind of like wanted to build like this grape arbor. So they would like provide shade for this one space and it didn't quite work out the way we wanted to. But.
Huh. I wonder if it's, you know, do you prune them back every year? Cause that's the other thing, but it's more for production. Is you want to prune them back to about 3 feet from the ground and just establish three main stems from a single trunk.
No. Nope, they're kind of wild all over, and they've got those cool woody things now from the older vines that are really pretty and neat.
Maybe try pruning them back. We cut ours back every year. And if you think about like old vineyards, you know, they're like 500 years old. Yeah. You know, they prune those things back to just, it looks like an oak stump, you know? But then, because you know, all the grapes are going to be on the new growth. So just like so many plants that, if you cut them back, you know, in the fall, once they've gone dormant, they'll produce a lot of new growth and a lot of new grapes.
Okay, cool. We'll have to try that.
Might be helpful, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe we've just gotten lucky, but I do like those kind of perennial plants. There's something very satisfying about that.
We're still waiting on a favorite recipe.
Oh, the recipe. Okay. Yeah, I'll try.
Like to cook.
Oh, I do. It was like kind of overwhelming. Okay, so this is.
It doesn't have to be a favorite recipe. Just a recipe.
No, this is good. This is a good question. So this is something. One thing I love about Thai food, apart from just like the bold, fresh flavors, is how easy they are to prepare. Very quick meal. Start to finish, it's less than 30 minutes.
Nice.
And, so Thai stir fries. And this is really where my garden comes in. Because I grow just about everything for them. Every vegetable that goes into Thai stir fry comes out of my garden. Fish sauce, huge, important ingredient. I buy that. I don't grow the fish or ferment the fish in my garden for it. But the key is it only takes, only takes half an hour to prepare. And the reason it's a half an hour, because that's how long it takes the rice to cook. The stir fry part only comes in for 15 minutes. But, and you can mix up some of the vegetables, but the key thing is, are a few ingredients, or every Thai stir fry just has a few ingredients, and every ingredient is incredibly important. And that's why you want them to be fresh. And that's why you want them to be the right ingredient. That's where substitutions can really dilute the flavor and the taste of it. So one of the most common stir fries, the basis of most stir fries is garlic, pepper, oil, fish sauce, some sort of charismatic mega vegetable like eggplant, for example, and a meat. And that's it. I mean, that's like, those are the ingredients. So the garlic, we grow in our garden. It's a Thai garlic, which has a very different taste than like the typical Italian variety or European varieties of garlic that you can get. Also has a thinner skin, so it's easier to prepare. But the taste, it's really neat. If you line up a whole bunch of garlic and just eat them raw, you can really taste the flavor, the difference of it. So garlic, that's a place to start. And here, I'll give you the, I'll just go through how to make a Thai stir fry. Okay. Using like a skillet or a wok, but actually a skillet is kind of better for our ovens that has to have high sides. Put in a tablespoon or two of vegetable oil, not olive oil, because that kind of has a strong flavor and it doesn't get hot enough. Get the oil just to the point where it smokes. When it starts doing that, throw in 5 or 8 cloves of, garlic, chopped up, pounded up.
Wow. So is very, like very the Thai garlic a little bit less strong, or is it?
It has just a different flavor. I mean, it's a little spicier, little.
I'm going to have to try that.
I can imagine it. I can't articulate it. It tastes like, yeah, it tastes different. Yeah. So, and the other thing is, too, like talking about how easy Thai food is to cook. I mean, they, the Thai love food. They love eating, just like me. All their preparation is really simple. You know, like a lot of people I know don't like to cook with garlic, which drives me, it was unfathomable to me, but because they don't like peeling the cloves and pressing it and then having to clean the press and blah, blah, blah. The best way to prepare, or the best way I've seen in Thailand of how to prepare garlic is using a hammer. Mm-hmm. Just smash it and maybe chop it up and throw it into the, and what the smashing does is it releases the oils. It also creates much more surface area. I mean, you're pulverizing it. Mm-hmm. So once that oil in your skillet gets just about to the smoking point, throw in 5 or 8 cloves of crushed, chopped up garlic. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's going to, you know, really sizzle, stir it really quickly. It's going to change the golden brown, and then add peppers, not just any peppers, but some Thai chili. And this, this is really what gives it that special flavor and the pop. And this is up to your own discretion, how many you're going to use. We actually grow, about 7 different types of Thai chilies, ranging in different sizes and heats. And heat, rather.
That's I like what I was really wondering spicy. About. You do? Okay.
Yeah, I like really spicy food. My wife doesn't, so we kind of go somewhere in between. But but there's ways to spice it up later.
That's so what I was thinking.
I'm sorry?
That's what I was thinking, because I'm married to somebody who doesn't like spicy food either. So I always spice mine at the end.
Yeah, exactly. Add the peppers, you know, add some sliced up peppers, depending on how hot you want it. Give it a quick stir. Add in meat. And most of ours, all the meat we eat is from what we get from hunting. So typically we're going to be eating deer, elk, antelope, turkey, or pheasant. Slice it really thin. Put it in there, give it a quick stir, and what you've created with that garlic and the oil is what they call a garlic oil. It makes a very heavily flavored oil. So let that coat the meat, just stir it around real briefly until it loses its red color. This is actually a good meal for red meat. Once it's cooked for a couple seconds, then add in chopped up eggplant. And again, the type of eggplant you use is really important. And we have a variety of Thai eggplants that we grow. So we use whatever's in season. Stir that around for a few minutes and throw on some Thai basil at the end, right when it's ready to serve. And there's a few different types of Thai basil. And again, just like garlic or the peppers, you know, Thai basil is much different than our Italian basil. It has a very, very different flavor, a different texture, different aroma, and when you start substituting, you can really lose that Thai flavor. So just by using just a few simple ingredients in less than 30 minutes, everything from the garden and what's not from the garden is either fish sauce or what's coming out of our freezer, which is probably deer or elk. You can have an incredibly flavorful stir fry.
Oh, it sounds
That's what
delicious.
I like to do from the garden.
Nice. That was so detailed. Listeners are going to love that, though. I think they're really going to like this, because I have gotten a few comments like, get off of your script. You're too glued to your script. And And they also tell me don't interrupt your guests so much. So I'm working on
trying
to
do a lot of editing here.
No, it's going to be perfect. I think they're going to love it. So, but we are kind of getting kind of at our time limit. So, did you have a book or a magazine? I mean, you gave us those great resources about the Cornell website. Was there anything you wanted to recommend for listeners?
Yeah, you know, there's in terms of wildlife gardening and the importance of native plants in the landscaping and landscapes. Anything by Doug Ptolemy. Bringing Nature Home is his most popular book, but even some of his scholarly articles are really worth reading. And then another book that's by a collection of authors is called The New American Landscape.
Nice.
And I think that really helps understand, helps articulate the role of landscapes, not only in the natural world, but the understanding them in the context of our country. And in terms of our expectations or ideals or society in general, it's a really wonderful book.
Cool. Perfect. Yeah. Okay. Ready for my final question?
Final question. Yes.
If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity or organization you're passionate about or a project you'd like to see put into action, which maybe for you would be for people to, you know, study native plants or put native plants in their thing. But, you know, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on a global scale?
Wow, that's a big one. Yeah. You know, I think the biggest thing I'd like to see change is people to be more mindful of our resources and consider them as being finite. Water, for example. You know, consider how you use water, especially in the landscape. And treat it as a very valuable resource. And even though you maybe said one thing, I'll throw a few more things in there. You know, the term sustainability gets thrown around a lot, and it's probably overused. But to me, it just means using fewer resources. And again, that speaks to water. You know, how can you use it more effectively? To me, it's so valuable, and that's why the only thing we water is what we're going to eat. But the other thing about sustainability that's so important is basically not making a decision or performing an action now that can't be reversed. And I think that sort of concept is very, very important. So how we treat our land, how we treat our gardens, how we treat plants, whether you're talking about from like an organic perspective, that's why organic gardening is sustainable. What am I trying to say here? Be more mindful of how we use resources. I think we've kind of developed into, unfortunately, with our landscapes, into these depictions of some other climate, some other culture. We have such beautiful and unique natural landscapes in our country to use as inspiration, and I hope people do. And I think that's going to benefit wildlife. It'll use fewer resources. It'll encourage people to get connected with the natural world, which I think we've lost touch with a bit. It'll encourage play. It'll encourage interest, and it'll encourage appreciation for a lot of the things that we have, or a lot of things that we're losing. A lot of our insects, wildlife, natural places. So that's what
Perfect.
I have to say. Okay.
How about an inspirational tip or quote to help motivate listeners to reach into the dirt and start their own garden? Or perhaps get their own native plants?
Yeah, I think just getting started. I mean, I think like I mentioned, gardening should be fun. It should be enjoyable and approachable. It shouldn't be expensive or complicated. And the best way to do that is to start. And there's so many resources available to us now, like online, Especially, I mean, you can find out the answer to anything. It might not be right, but you can find out an answer just by searching. And just not to be afraid to get started and start small, but just start. I've been so fortunate. I think, you know, one of my greatest inspirations is my wife, Marilyn. She's a fantastic botanist. And, you know, I think we have a good partnership in the garden as well as in life. She's such a resource to me. But it's something that, you know, we've, you know, embarked on this together, and it's been a really, really fun and rewarding thing. I think if we had a different yard, our lives would be very much different. We spend so much time, you know, decompressing in the evening by, you know, walking around the garden, seeing what's flowering, seeing what insects are out, seeing how things are changing, looking after the vegetables, things like that. I mean, it's such a part of our life, and we don't consider it work. It's fun. It's interesting. It's always something new, and we use our yard. And, you know, I think that's a big deal. I think a lot of people, like I said, you know, they come home from work and they go inside or they go out to explore nature. Mm-hmm. But it can just be right outside your door. It can be something you can interact with every single day.
Well, I think you're really going to have inspired listeners today, and just especially ones who do have busy lives, and, you know, gardening can seem overwhelming. And so the thought of being able to plant things and then not have to worry about taking care of them and watering them and doing a lot of the hard work, the weeding and that comes with gardens, I think you're going to really inspire people. And then also to be able to bring the birds and the insects and the salamander. Like, I always still get excited. My mom's in New York on Long Island in the crowded suburbs. She's always got salamanders coming out from under the rocks in her herb garden. And they have lots of rabbits in New York now. But, yeah, those salamanders are fun, and lizards and snakes. My brother was always collecting snakes when we were kids.
Yeah, exactly.
And frogs that's and toads. And,
yeah,
you know.
That's such a neat thing about the East. It's like Montana is like a herpetological desert, you know. You just don't have, like, the, you know, it's very different. But that gets kids so excited.
Yeah.
And, you know, the funny thing is a little bit of an aside, but, you know, I think, you know, there's obviously this sort of, like, misunderstanding that, you know, especially if you have kids, that you have to have a big lawn, and that's what kids want. And I think now there's kind of a realization with the ideas of, like, nature play and unstructured play and stuff like that, that people are realizing you just need dirt, and that's what kids want. But it's,
plants, they love plants and flowers, like crawls, like you were talking about. You've got all these little places to sit and hang out. They love stuff like that.
Exactly, yeah. And it just goes back to, like, what we're both saying. I mean, like, turning over rocks, seeing what bugs are there, catching toads, you know, looking for snakes, you know, that kind of thing. It's so much more interactive and provides so much more, you know, learning and ways for people to engage their yard. You know, most people just sit, you know, on their, you know, back porch, back deck, and stare at their lawn and think of the work that it involves, as opposed to getting out there and looking for, you know, trying to catch a grasshopper or dragonfly or butterfly, or looking at what's underneath this log or what's been eating this plant, or that kind of thing. It really changes how you use your yard, and people realize that pretty quickly. Once they're exposed to it. And we have a lot of friends with young children, and they love coming over to our house to just explore, you know. And we don't live next to, you know, a wilderness area or along a stream or on the urban fringe. We live right in town, and you can have all this. Everybody can have it. And it doesn't have to cost a lot, and you'll have fun doing it. It's not work. I mean, I saw one of your questions was, what's the thing you like
least favorite activity?
And I could not, I mean, honestly, I could not think of anything, because, you know, like I described what weeding is like in our yard. You know, it's exploring. I love looking around, seeing what's going on. And yeah, digging up plants, potting them up, giving them to friends, or moving them around in the yard. You know, even for work, I spend a lot of time outside, but I still love just coming home and just poking around the garden at night. And I don't consider any of it work or any of it a task that I don't like. And I think it's because, you know, we've created something that really is what we enjoy. But it's not work. Yeah.
The two things you made me think of is like, so my mom's house, it backs up against a school. And it's a Waldorf school, so they have like this little nature path that goes kind of along her property line. And there's this little fairy garden that they've built for their kids. And there's like, you know, all these like upside down pots for like little fairy houses that they've built, and stones and rockways and paths. And they've just made this whole cute little fairy village that every time I go there, I love to see the changes. And you can tell that the kids have been playing in that. And then the other thing, as a teacher and an educator, you know, there's just, when you were talking about the animals, I mean, it's just such a great way to get kids to, you know, express themselves. And boys especially, I always find, are much more interested in nonfiction than fiction. And, you know, there's just so much science you can get that, you know, because the emphasis today is all about writing and reading and math, you know, reading, writing, math. The lower elementary, like, science is just out the door, and social studies, and, you know, so, but... I just said, tell listeners how to connect with you. Tell them your blog again, and if they wanted to reach out.
Yeah, so you are welcome. All the listeners are welcome to come to my garden, and you can find that on my garden journal, which is my blog. You can have a look at my garden anytime. It's Montana Wildlife Gardener at Blogspot. And if you just search for Montana Wildlife Gardener, you'll probably also find my Instagram and Twitter feeds, but
cool.
Yeah, check out my blog, also on Facebook.
Okay. Thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing all of this. I know listeners are going to love this, because like I said, they told me
thank you so much.
Not talk so much and get away from my script a little. So. You did an awesome job.
I feel like
job.
I just kind of, thanks. I feel like I rambled a lot, and I don't envy your task of having to edit this, but hopefully there's some useful stuff. So,
oh, really? I
appreciate
I'm not going to have to edit anything. I can just put this straight up.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Organic Gardener Podcast. I'd like to encourage you to visit our website at awesomemontana.com. That's just AWESOMEMONTANA.com. Like Awesome Montana, all spelled out. And click on Mike's Green Garden and the Organic Gardener Podcast, and it will link right to the show notes and all the things we've talked about on today's show. Thanks again for listening, and grow local.